This is Talk Is Cheap on KPW LP 97.3 of Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, simulcast on kpw.org, and archived on radioforall.net. So today, a potpourri of news stories that are still poignant, and but mainly Growers Market here in Eugene. I wanted to promote, very important right now, to support mutual aid is the solution. You know, if your school is being closed, go to your mutual aid society and start your own school that your middle class world is collapsing around you. And I hope you'll stick out your phone when your hospital is closing down and mothers and children are crying because their hospitals are closing down, or the polluting industry corporation has spilled pollutants in your backyard and there's crying children. Go out there. It's important to go out there and document this on your phone. And I give you my word, we'll find a way to archive this so that future aliens and the future world will see that we tried to stop this collapse, this arrogant collapse. And the way we're going to do it is, I just want to talk about the DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America. I'm hearing a lot of chatter about that. What I'm not hearing is, you know, I talked to them in D.C. during the election, and what it is, there's an emphasis on democracy, and this is where I think the anarchists and the communists and the socialists can finally, maybe historically, can get together. And these guys are more Trotskyists, in my opinion, than Leninists or Stalinists. And that's what we want to stay away from, the Stalinist part of. Usually, permaculture, you don't want centralized things. And in sustainability, which is what this show is kind of based on, we don't want to centralize things. But I can see that we have just ruined things so badly that we're going to need a central. We're going to need to take over some major industries here and then decentralize them. And, like I say, what we have in common with the socialists, the anarchists, is this idea of direct democracy. And I think we need to push and keep the socialists on the direct democracy. And I think that's what they want. And that's what they tell me, is that there will be democracy and this will be chosen by the masses in a direct, flattened democracy way. So that's all I wanted to say, Growers Market, and some potpourri, some other news stories that I think are important, and some solutions that I try to give you here on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks, Independent Community Radio. Support independent radio and radio for all, and stick your phone out and send it to whatever, don't send it to us if you don't want to, send it to your own favorite independent outlet. Growers Market is an all-volunteer, not-for-profit food buying club for buying organic and natural foods. The market is run entirely by volunteers with a consensus-based democratic process. Their purposes are to provide quality food at an excellent price, support sustainable agriculture, and promote social change within our community and beyond. The top floor of their building is made up of offices rented to nonprofit social change groups. The board of directors of the Growers Market, which includes representatives of both the food buying club and the upstairs tenants, meets once a month, and these meetings are open to anyone who wants to attend. I have used Growers Market building at the north end of Willamette Street for activist meetings since 1985, but I've neglected the market part of the Growers Market. So I went through the membership orientation with long-term member volunteer Doug Black.
We were founded in the late 1960s when much of the kind of countercultural revolution was undergoing its naissance, its birth. We moved here and we bought this building in 1971, so we're now 50, going on 55 years old later this year. And we've had many, many great people come through over those years, and many of them are still here, like myself. We're all volunteer except for a part-time paid building manager and their maintenance person. So when you see people around here, there's no hierarchy. It's more just based on experience and some wisdom kicking in. And when you see someone, you can generally approach most anyone and ask if you're feeling a little unclear about what's going on. So we're all on an equal footing here. We work by consensus decision-making as well. There's no kind of, as I say, no hierarchy, no kind of boss that we stress. This is our mission statement, which kind of oversees in a loose way, the operation of the Food Blind Club. The Food Blind Club's primary purpose shall be to assist the community in obtaining adequate nutrition through educational information and by making healthful foods available at low cost, especially to the poor and the elderly, to whom high quality nutrition might not otherwise be available. Okay, our ethics are, no pardoning the pun, very firmly rooted in making available organics. Organics are the sustenance of the earth. They're gonna, that's where we came from, that's where we're going. Petrochemicals will fade into the past. Also stressing local, locally grown, locally manufactured or packaged. I'll point you out a few of those local businesses. And also in the reduction of packaging. So we encourage you to bring your own bags, jars, bottles, etc. Okay, upstairs, we own the building, so we rent out space upstairs, as you know. You probably spent time up there for the general public who's never been there. There are some really cool low-cost, low-revenue nonprofits that we think reflect our mission toward the public as to what we would like to see in businesses. Go upstairs and check out the information table sometime. It's in the big building, the big meeting room, community meeting room, directly above us. Or you can also sign out on an old-fashioned analog calendar, meeting calendar. You can sign up for meetings there. The one caveat that we have for a community is that you do not do a fundraising. There's no fundraising allowed here. No passing of cash or money.
Well, just briefly, though, this has been instrumental since the 70s in organizing actions, including the Warner Creek, I know I would think, yeah. And the growers market was instrumental in all of this.
Yeah, there's been a lot of progressive organizations here. There was the anti-clear-cut referendum group. Gary Kucher ran for many years. They had an office upstairs that had the ballot referendum.
Mind Freedom's been there for years.
Peace Cause, yeah, they're the oldest long-term tenant that we have in the building. It's a great nexus for progressive causes in Eugene. That's no doubt. The main entrance is on Willamette Street between the two restaurants.
It's not your average corporate shopping experience.
These are do's and don'ts. We have very limited back storage space to hold vegetables. So if you figure out just shortly before you come to the market, say on a Thursday afternoon, that you're going to have a big party at your house and you need to make a gallon of guacamole, please do not take a whole box of avocados, because we don't have, we anticipate on a yearly cycle and a monthly cycle where we're going to be, how much we're going to be spending for produce. You could quickly exhaust our order. We instead encourage you to go and shop at another locally owned store like Red Barn or Kiva or Sundance. They would love to have your business as well. There's more than one organic store, community store in town. Sorry to say.
You're getting different distributors than they do, or how would you?
We use one wholesaler that's very common with grocery items across the United States. That's UNFI, United Foods. They deliver to us weekly. There's also organically grown company. We get most of our produce comes from organically grown. They're based in they have an office warehouse in Eugene. We like dealing with them. That's a good notice for your listeners, because they have a pretty good awareness of how the American food system and the food diet is grossly out of line with the climate, and how it's driving the climate to change, because we on average, the ratio I heard years ago, probably still current, there's 10 calories of energy that go into growing and delivering to your plate. One calorie of food. That's a totally obscene relationship. 10 to 1 to get you your food. So what we do is we stress, as Organically Grown does, to shorten that distance between the producer, meaning the farmer, and we, the consumer, or the end, or the store that it's being delivered to.
Right, so you want things less than 500 miles away, ideally.
It's the average. It would be nice if it was that, if it came from only the Northwest, which is what they strive to do. Of course, winters are not going to work that way. California is where most of this comes from. But, it's a screwy ratio that's just hammering the climate. So we have to be aware of that. And if we don't encourage ourselves, of course, to grow our own gardens at home. So,
but the quantity issue isn't about the distributor, it's about the way you guys run things. In order, you only order what you need.
We have to watch out, though. We're not a CSA. We're getting there's one or two local farms that we might get delivered directly from us in the summer. They will have usually Lost Creek Farms will have their boxes set up over here in the summer when they have it. But I also don't want you to go too far to think that, well, we've got this really nice button-down, top-down system that only gets food locally, like in the summer, et cetera. We don't. It's hard. It's hard to do that. I think the best thing we can do in addition to this is to encourage everyone to find like a city plot for the gardening, or to grow their own foods at home as much as they
can. And use this to supplement your own food growing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's what we do at home.
You're probably going to have to do that coming soon.
You might, if this current memo of understanding doesn't, if that dissolves, we're back to running out of oil. So, but let's see what happens.
You need to know what tear is.
That's our tear scale. You know what a tear scale, a tear is?
Yeah,
tear
it's weight? The weight that you don't charge for.
Correct. Basically. It's for the container or the bag, and you don't want to get charged for that, especially if it's glass. It's very dense, so that's where you weigh it out first. And that's also another thing you want to write down. Besides the unit price, you've got to write down any tear weights so that they can discount, punch it into the scale up here when you're getting ready to pay.
So it's going to be my own container. I'm going to weigh my own container.
Yeah.
So
I want
to write down the weight of my own container, and I'm going to use it again.
Definitely want to record that. Unless you've got a photographic memory,
right,
you're going to want to write it down.
I swear I only buy Lost Leaders from Walmart, okay?
When we started in 1971, there was no other place you could go. This is the way food buying clubs and food co-ops, what their base foundation was. When we started, it was because shoppers couldn't find organic food. We were the place that they would go to. This is where you go to find organic, non-petrochemically grown food.
Because you had to order it with other people. You couldn't get it individually.
Yeah, and so we all coalesced around that, and that's the way that it was. In the last 55 years, we've had so much change in the marketplace, not just in Eugene, but across the United States. It's the industry, the availability of organic foods is just skyrocketed. So we're in essence, by default, kind of, in a way, competing, I say that very loosely, competing with other stores in town that carry a good variety of organic foods. So that's our revenues and our sales have not stayed constant over the last 50 years.
And then we need these things because this creates community.
Absolutely. It's not an anonymous place you go. I rarely meet, if I do have to go to another store, rarely do I meet people I know when I go in those stores. Here I've got friends, you know, I've known these people I've made friends with here that I've been, for 27 years.
Just cleaning with somebody, you might make a friend or...
Right.
Yeah, much more
Absolutely.
Connection than you would in a regular store.
Absolutely. That's,
even a regular health food store.
So it's healthy in that way. It gives you peace of mind, and it gives you more connectedness and mental health, really, to know that you know where your food's coming from and you know where the people are from that are helping you get your food.
I got, you know, I used to take my packaging back to Walmart, because I live near Walmart, so I do end up shopping there. I went for 20 years without shopping there, but...
Turn the recorder off.
Well, no, I want this on here. And so now I can't take my packaging back to them. They've taken the trash cans out, so now I can't take my packaging back to them.
You can find out more about Growers Market by going to growersmarket.net or calling 541-687-1145. 541-687-1145. Over the last century, native people have moved or were forced to relocate to urban areas because of government policy, lack of economic and educational opportunities, and limited access to healthcare and other services. But in an unfamiliar world, many native people struggled. For thousands of years, their families were part of unique communities where the practice of culture and tradition was part of everyday life. That no longer existed, and urban Indians were shamed and would struggle with their identities. They also found that the care they received by health organizations did not meet their unique health needs, which would eventually give rise to urban Indian programs and health organizations that provided services that better aligned with the needs of the urban Indian community. Today, American Indians and Alaska Natives still move to urban areas for educational, employment, and housing opportunities and healthcare needs, resulting in an urban indigenous population that is enormously diverse and intertribal. Though there is more access to culturally attuned health and human services today, urban Indians still suffer from health disparities at disproportionate rates compared to other ethnic groups. Chronic disease, infectious disease, and unintended injury with extraordinarily high levels of comorbidity and mortality are just some of the health areas where urban Indians experience higher rates than others. Urban Indian Health Organizations, or UIHOs, which are private nonprofit corporations that serve American Indian, Alaska Native people in select cities with a range of health and social services from outreach and referral to full ambulatory care, UIHOs are a network of 33 independent health agencies funded in part under Subtitle 4 of the Indian Health Care Improvement Act, formerly Title 5, and receive limited grants and contracts from the Federal Indian Health Service, or IHS. UIHOs are located in 19 states, supporting individuals in approximately 100 U.S. counties in which over 1.2 million AI/ANs reside, according to the 2010 U.S. Census. UIHOs provide traditional health care services, cultural activities, and a culturally appropriate place for urban AIANs to receive health care. UIHI staff work on multiple ongoing research projects to benefit urban American Indian and Alaska Natives. In this dynamic lecture series called Breaking History, Pulitzer Prize-nominated journalist Mark Trahant details some of the most important yet unsung canon events that make up the indigenous story that are sure to surprise and upend the narratives that we have been force-fed for generations. In this powerful episode, Mark Trahant dives into Lee Cook, a key architect of the urban native movement in the 1970s, a moment when tribes began demanding real investment for native people living off-reservation. Cook's leadership helped force federal recognition of urban native needs, including a $40 million funding recommendation from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. That funding never came. The Nixon administration shut it down, creating a service gap in health, housing, and social support that still haunts Native communities today. Trahant spoke with Cook's niece, Holly Cook Macaro, about the political decisions that erased urban Native lives from the national agenda and why the consequences of that creative disruption are still unfolding.
On January 15, 1972, representatives from six urban centers gathered in Oakland, California to send a message that it was long past time for the country to have services for urban Native populations. The Bureau of Indian Affairs dismissed the meeting, saying that all federal funds will go to reservations. The premise, of course, is that the United States' relationship was directly with tribal nations. But urban Native Americans should get services that they're entitled to, just as any other citizens of cities, counties, and states. The National American Indian Council was formed by some 300 delegates representing 58 cities. The council met in Omaha, Nebraska in March 1972 and called for the extension of federal services to all Indians. Lee Cook, Red Lake Ojibwe was president of the National Congress of American Indians. He invited the new organization to join a broader coalition on Native issues. He said it was practical and politically expedient to organize around needs as you define them. Under Cook's leadership, NCAI revised its membership to include Native people living in cities. NCAI cannot take a stand against its own people, whether they are urban or not. NCAI's director, Leo Vasu, who is Oglala, said, urban Indians are not getting their fair share of city services, and NCAI would support them getting a fair share. Lee Cook was a key voice in the debate. He was a figure from this era that we should really make sure is part of our collective memory. So I reached out to Holly Cook McCarro to talk about her uncle.
You know, Lee was an uncle to me and on my dad's side, and he really was on a personal level an inspiration for really wanting to do politics. I remember being at Lee's house as a child and seeing the pictures of him with Mondale, you know, with all of these elected officials. When we talk about being able to see that happen, it didn't seem like it was impossible for me to go and do political work, right? And because I'd seen Lee do that, and Lee's story is one I think about. He broke so many barriers from being elected to the tribal council as an urban representative and inspiring then an amendment to the Constitution that then banned urban representatives to the Red Lake Tribal Council. But his daughter last week had found an old shirt where it said, you know, Lee Cook for Alderman. And then to the footage that we've seen where he was nominated as vice president at the Chicago Convention in 1968. And to see him up on the podium, those old pictures of Lee up on the podium and speaking. To then move on to his time under Louis Bruce, when they decided to bring in, you know, Indians for the first time to run the BIA, and that whole cadre, which they called the Cats and Jammer Kids, and getting into all sorts of good trouble there. I say good trouble from an administrative standpoint. And then Lee resigned in protest about the treatment of Louis Bruce by some of the administration and some of the things, you know, that were happening or not happening in the administration. And then immediately turned around and ran for president of NCAI. So he was elected, and I believe in the fall of 1971, if I recall correctly, as president of NCAI, and served in that position through the historic, was it Tulsa in 74, I believe? Yeah. Those were absolutely historic times in terms of activism, butting heads with those who had decided to work on the inside, how that all came together in terms of leadership of the National Congress of American Indians at that time. It's an important piece of history in how we could work in Indian country from the inside and out with what some saw as an opportunity. We were moving from complete control and administration by the federal government on Indian lands towards self-determination and self-governance, which was a huge growing pain and understandably a scary thing for tribal leadership back then. Watching all of, knowing what I've learned, you know, about the American Indian movement and what I know about the activism, the, I would say, administrative activism within the walls by folks like Ernie Stevens and Lee Cook and others. It's an important story, and I'm really proud of Lee's voice, and he was always a character in our family, and we miss him. You know, it was just his birthday last week, so.
You think of creative disruption. And of course, now we're going through, and it's kind of mean-spirited, but the creative disruption at the BIA during that period, when you had really two centuries of bureaucrats doing things exactly the same way all the time, and then to have this force of folks saying, no, we're not going to do that.
Yeah, and I think it put our Native folks in a very difficult position, right?
We are now in a period of disruption. It's a crazy disruption, but the 1970s had its own share of crazy disruption, and the BIA certainly was a big part of that.
Yes, absolutely, and I think looking at the team that was there and the experience they brought with them is such a fascinating piece of history, because we have to learn from that. We have to learn from the folks who went in a very difficult atmosphere with not a lot of structural support within, you know, and maybe that's why none of them lasted very long. And then we had the takeover of the BIA, but, you know, the entire structure the disruption that was happening both inside and outside the walls. This is when we were having, you know, this we had Wounded Knee in 73, we had Jumping Bull in 75, we had these changes going on. And Lee's election as NCI president, I really think also symbolizes a change from the old guard to the new kids. You know, he ran against Earl Oldperson, who, you know, what a tremendous tribal leader, an iconic historic figure in Indian country, and who was against self-governance, you know, on all of those pieces. And I completely understand it, because that had to have been such an unknown for tribal leadership. If we go that way, do we lose our funding? Are we putting all of that in jeopardy? And so answering those questions in the unknown of whether the federal government would live up to the commitments and support of self-governance and self-determination was kind of that election when Lee was elected in 1971 of, does the old guard win? Does the new guard win? And so when Lee won, and it really was, I think, a change in voice at the National Congress, and leaning towards that new day, and some of the legislation that we saw pass in the late 1970s, from, you know, the Religious Freedom Act to the Indian Self-Determination Education Assistance Act, or what we call ISDA, which is the foundation of so much of the work that we do today, and point to as the laws that, from land into trust to federal recognition and beyond. It's almost hard to in just a few minutes encompass the disruption that was happening inside, outside, and what that resulted in.
As I mentioned at the top of the show, one of those disruptions was a debate about federal services directed toward urban Indians. Neither the Bureau of Indian Affairs nor the Indian Health Service has ever taken that mission on, at least in a big way. A Bureau of Indian Affairs report in 1972 did make a suggestion to expand services, in fact, recommending $9.3 million be sent for Indians in cities, whether or not they lived on or off reservations. The report was prepared at the request of then Representative Julia Butler Hansen from Washington State, who was chairman of the House Appropriations Committee. The report was authored by Ernie Stevens Sr., Alexander Sandy McNabb, and others in BIA leadership. The American Indian, or the Native American so-called, has rights in this land which predate all subsequent rights which have been accrued to Europeans and other immigrants to the United States, the report said. The rights of Indians were steadily eroded with each new wave of settlers. Illegal and broken treaties, disease, war, manifest destiny, and downright deception, together with negligent performance of the federal trust, have aided this erosion. The BIA actually recommended spending $46 million on urban programs out of a $1 billion budget. But the Nixon administration said no. From the White House, Frank Carlucci wrote Interior to say that the BIA's responsibility does not extend to Indians who have left the reservation. He said there were other federal agencies that could fill that role. Carlucci had been head of the Office of Economic Opportunity, the very agencies he said should be supporting urban Indian programs. Yet that agency spent only about $600,000 on such efforts. That huge gap, healthcare, social service, housing, remains as great as ever. I'm Mark Trahant, and this is Breaking History.
Decolonized data is available for Indigenous people by Indigenous people at the Urban Indian Health Institute at uihi.org. That's Urban Indian Health Institute at uihi.org.
This is KEPW 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio.
Seattle has an innovative way of turning vacant commercial storefronts into space with unlimited potential. Smaller cities like Eugene and Springfield could do the same. Seattle Restored calls on local artists and entrepreneurs to reinvigorate Seattle by activating empty storefronts. Seattle Restored is a project of Shinpike, Seattle Good Business Network, and the Seattle Office of Economic Development. While strolling Belltown, you might pass by the unassuming windows of River without even realizing it. But inside this surprising 3,000 square foot space in a 100-year-old historic building are two passionate event organizers with a crush on creatives.
I'm Jessica Gabronski.
And I'm Erica Vasquez Jen.
And together, we are the owners of River. Our opportunity for what we could accomplish just expanded instantly, because this is bigger than what we had imagined. And this used to be an event space. And so we're like, okay, we don't want to just curate art shows and vintage and vendors. we want to have an event space that can be used for creatives to basically take them to the next level.
I think that a huge reason why Jessica and I work well together is because we see people the same. And I would say that coordinating events is a lot of getting to know the curators and the artists and their passion and what brought them to pursue, you know, their outlet. So I would say just hearing from the creatives and how much they need just a space to be and showcase, I would say that would be the best part about what we do.
We are an event space open to any sort of booking there is, weddings, corporate, you know, offsite, holiday party, what have you. But, you know, that was meant to be a tagline to really emphasize that we want to be here specifically for creatives, not exclusively to creatives, but we truly have a heart for our fellow artists, etc. And so we really want this space to, you know, predominantly be used for platforming creatives.
Through the program, small business owners collaborate with property owners to bring life to commercial spaces in downtown Seattle and surrounding neighborhoods. By offering these spaces, participating property owners enhance the diversity and vibrancy of their communities and support the local economy. Seattle Restored provides property owners up to $1,500 per month based on the type of activation. The program will obtain liability insurance for each activated property for the duration of the activation. Seattle Restored will supply a lease agreement for review and final approval of terms. Property owners provide a ground floor property that has access to electricity, collaborate on approval process for modifications and historic district applications as needed, and be available to coordinate space improvements. What they gain is an opportunity to create goodwill in their community, introduce their space to prospective future long-term tenants, have their space professionally photographed for future use, and be a part of properties included in a citywide multimedia campaign. Mia Stevenson is from the Good Business Network of Washington, and Brooke Sanders is from the Seattle Office of Economic Development.
Seattle Restored is really reactivating our city's commercial corridors by connecting artists and businesses to vacant spaces and bringing opportunities to businesses to pop up while also serving properties and neighborhoods by bringing visibility and activity back to storefronts that have been sitting vacant for a long time. Seattle Restored launched at the end of 2021, so it was a COVID response measure with federal relief funding. The city saw that there was a lot of vacancy occurring and also a lot of small businesses were suffering during that time. So it began as a measure to kind of counteract all of the vacant storefronts on the ground level, as well as provide opportunities for small businesses and artists to gain a little bit of economic stability during that time.
Seattle Restored has a few goals. One of which is to bring small businesses and creative entrepreneurs to the forefront of our city planning. We prioritize groups that have been historically marginalized in traditional leases or financing and really put them at the forefront of reducing barriers for them to access short-term leases. And it is our hope that these businesses, after joining us in a pop-up model, are interested in leasing space downtown. And that goes in with our second goal of encouraging property owners and people with these vacancies in our priority neighborhoods to want to participate in the revitalization of our city by incorporating some of these small businesses that are maybe representative of tenants that they are not necessarily familiar with seeing. And it gives a great opportunity for the two to merge and pair and create something incredibly unique in our retail corridors.
I think having a thriving art community and a diverse population of small businesses and entrepreneurs is really vital to a city's health. Artists and small businesses create space for people to connect and gather. They create new experiences for people to have in their own city. They're also feeding into our local economy. When you spend money with a local artist or entrepreneur, most of that money is staying within the local ecosystem. So keeping money within the Seattle system helps us build wealth, helps us build financial, economic viability as a city, and again, really allows our community to connect together. When you support Seattle Restored, you support a vibrant and successful local economy where the whole community can thrive.
My name's Raymond. I'm a paper artist, so I tear things up and stick them down.
As an artist, when you're creating work, you always think about, will someone buy this, or what am I doing? So you are expressing yourself, but in the back of your mind, you're going, is anyone going to like this? Whereas with Seattle Restored, you're just activating a space, and so you can do whatever you want, and it shows that that space is cared for. And so originally I had planned just to put artwork in the window, and then when I saw the space, I went, I'm going to create a massive 3D diorama in this space. And it's a really good opportunity just to try something new and do whatever you want. It's remarkable. So if you want to get involved, the best thing to do is contact me on Instagram. You can see my work there. I have a website. I'm everywhere. And also on the Seattle Restored shopfront, you can see my work there and go to the website from there as well.
Both Springfield and Eugene development plans have provisions for renovating existing buildings to improve urban life quality. Tax increment revenue generated through Eugene's two urban renewal districts in downtown is the primary financial tool for downtown projects. This revenue can be used for a wide range of development purposes within each district, from land acquisition to renovation and facade improvements. The city's urban renewal district plans include the requirements of the districts and list examples of downtown-related projects. Funds received from the federal government each year can be used for activities such as job creation and elimination of slums and blight. The Eugene City Council has expressed interest in an unmaintained property tax to pay for programs like this, but has not moved forward on it as yet. For more information and a list of events at storefronts, go to info@seattlerestored.org. That's info@seattlerestored.org.
There's a scourge threatening the airwaves right now. I'm talking about that earworm wrangler and rhyme criminal, Justin Bieber. I don't care if he gets his coke from Colombia, his product from Pennsylvania. He should be arrested just for rhyming holy with hold me. His music is vapid, his lyrics are trite. Now don't kill Justin Bieber. Cutting his hair will only slow him down. If you want to stop Justin Bieber and others like him, go to kepw.org and become a sustaining member, or just send a couple of dollars. We're all volunteers, so you get more bang for your buck. Go to kepw.org and stop inane music today.
Brought to you by Crazy Larry MD's Procedure Emporium, where they're crazy for your health care. Hi, I'm Crazy Larry MD from Crazy Larry MD's Procedure Emporium, where we're crazy for your health care. We guarantee to charge you only 100% of what your insurance pays after they pay it, or whatever's higher, with approved collateral. Come on down, we'll give you a free ride in my Bugatti. Our internationally sought surgeon will have you for dinner once you pay your bill. Free vasectomy by Rabbi Cutswell with every operation. This week's special, open heart surgery, just $50,000, sutures not included. At Crazy Larry MD's, call for the latest location. I'm crazy for your health care.
Brought to you by BJ's Bottled Air, the only bottled air manufactured in a plant powered by the very charcoal it's filtered through. Each bottle comes with a free trach tube ribbed and lubricated for pleasurable insertion. Pick up some BJ's Bottled Air today while you still can.
And now, a message from your Department of Health.
Hello, my name is Safety Sam, and I'm here to spread the word about a health problem of great importance to us all. Did you know that VD, venereal disease, has reached epidemic proportions in our city? Well, you should know the facts about this public menace in order to protect yourself and those you love. Venereal diseases, syphilis and gonorrhea, are diseases transmitted only through intimate physical contact. They are both extremely dangerous, and left untreated, result in blindness, heart trouble, insanity, and death. Here are some of the early warning signs to watch out for. If you are a man and experience a burning sensation or itching when you urinate, you may have gonorrhea. If you are a man or a woman and discover a chancre on your privates, you may have syphilis. If spotted in time, a doctor can cure you of a venereal disease infection. But once cured, you have no insurance against recontamination. For more information, write or call the Department of Health office in your community. Remember, the war against venereal disease is your war. Therefore, observe the golden rule of good health. A bird in the hand is better than one in the bush. Thank you.
Direct from our newsroom in New York, it's the Channel 1 Evening News with Robert Elgin and Leo Batfish in Suckmuck Dick, Thurston Thithertinton in Bath, Mechanica Mechanica in Washington, D.C., Freddie Fago in Minneapolis, and Lionel Elgin in New York.
Good evening. Enemy sappers attacked Allied supply bases in Long Wang earlier today. Casualties were reported high in the Gulf of Kaki and in near Pukyu, where enemy helicopters were downed by rock-throwing peasant women. General Chow, commander of Allied forces in Long Wang, divided his troops into two columns and ordered three units from Column A and two units from Column B into ground fighting there. American troops were on hand, and here with a report is Leo Batfish in Suckmuck Dick.
These are the proud and plucky fighting men of the screaming 103rd Airborne Cavalry, secretly stationed here in Long Wang to support and destroy in this protective overreaction mission known as Operation Bloodbath. These battle-hardened, shell-shocked elite corps has covertly hauled heavy artillery through rice paddies, cow paddies, jungles, and swamps, moving under cover of darkness to avoid being accidentally bombed by stray B-52s. The Screaming 103rd is part of the Terminal Pacification Program, initiated by an unknown sonographer at the Pentagon in 1968. And so, for these men, war or no war, enemy or no enemy, this dreadful, dreary, drab, draconian drama drags on. This is Leo Batfish in Suckmuck Dick.
The Russians' new space program got off to an inauspicious start today, apparently due to a gas leak aboard the giant Scratchinich 3 rocket. Here, via satellite, is a taped report from Thurston Thithertinton in Bath.
The Soviet Union today launched a Scratchinich 3 rocket with one Russian cosmonaut aboard. Soon after takeoff, the trouble began. Director of the mission, Vladimir Getcharoksov, alerted the flight commander, Yuri Vosnovsky, of a dangerous amyl nitrate leak into the rocket's fresh air and cooling system. Apparently dazed by the noxious chemical, Commander Vosnovsky disregarded orders and, donning his spacesuit, jumped out of the giant spacecraft. Narrowly escaping doom with the aid of his British-built jet-propelled rocket pack, the berserk Russian spaceman, apparently enraged by the technical malfunctions plaguing the Soviet space program, launched a one-man assault on the mission control headquarters. In a typically Russian display of pique, Vosnovsky fought for several minutes with scientists involved in the ill-fated launching. Alexei Rudnakhmy, an authority on solar wind and former Olympic discus thrower, finally overcame cosmonaut Vosnovsky by driving him into the atomic pile. His present condition is unknown. Meanwhile, the abandoned rocket on a collision course for St. Peter's Basilica in Rome was detonated. This is Thurston Thithertinton in Bath.
Uranus, we're just beginning to find out. The president went to the airwaves this evening in a televised address to the nation. Commenting upon the spirit of dissent abroad in the land, the president reaffirmed his confidence in the basic strength of the American people.
I'm in the driver's seat. I run the show. I'm the president.
Earlier in the day, the president welcomed the Prime Minister of India, Mrs. Mahatma Yenta. Mechanica Mechanica reports from the nation's capital.
After a day spent in consultation with the Prime Minister and her aides, the President took the demure world leader on an informal tour of the White House Rose Garden. Later, they spoke to reporters.
I would like to thank the marvelous people of the United States for the great reception they showed me here, and of course the hospitality of your great President. Thank you.
Thank you. Isn't she terrific? I mean, this woman is the head of a country with thousands of starving people, and she herself, as you can see, look at this. She's not starving. This takes imagination. This takes courage. And that is it. That's it. That's it.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you. You're wonderful. You know that? You're really something. I'm really going to take you. You're really going to like America. America's going to be your favorite country. I'll say that.
The assassination attempt in the Rose Garden was the 23rd such incident since the president took office, and the second in the last 5 days.
Acceptance Corporation.
Radiation. Yes, indeed. You hear the most outrageous lies about it. Half-baked Gogglebox do-gooders telling everybody it's bad for you. Pernicious nonsense. Everybody could stand 100 chest x-rays a year. They ought to have to. When they canceled the project, it almost hit me in. One day my mind was a little burst. The next day, nothing. Show them. I had a lobotomy, Nina.
Lobotomy? Isn't that for loonies?
Not at all. A friend of mine had one. Designer of the neutron bomb. You ever hear of the neutron bomb? Destroys people. Leaves buildings standing. Fits in a suitcase. So small. No one knows it's there till blam! Eyes melt, skin explodes, everybody dead. So immoral working on a sinking driving mat. That's what happened to this friend of mine. So he had a lobotomy. Now he's well again.
What kind of car does your friend drive?
Chevy Malibu.
This is really a nice old car. Let me drive.
What do you mean?
Well, I don't know. I mean, don't you feel funny?
Why should I feel funny? The two hemispheres are fundamentally at odds. Hemisphere. You know, it's strange. I do.
Brought to you by Polythene Peninsula. Don't wait to get in on the seafloor of this earth-shattering real estate opportunity. Made from 100% post-consumer plastic, these houses and the entire development are built to last for millennia. We have a few units in the low 250s still left. Act now and we guarantee, while they last, fresh packaged fish on your doorstep twice daily. Polythene Peninsula, spreading the future across the globe.
Good evening, we are Rage Against the Machine from Los Angeles, California.
We'll be right back.
Our town is turning.